This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong. Welcome to This Working Life. We kick off this episode with a little stat for those who are numbers people amongst us. So last year, over a quarter of a million Australians were made redundant, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. So the chances are that you know someone who has dealt with or is facing redundancy. Maybe you have. Losing your job can be one of the most stressful things in your life, particularly if you have dependents. But for some people, it can be the catalyst that they needed. 10 years ago, Kim Ellis was working as a research chemist for BHP Billiton in Newcastle when her position was made redundant. Kim was 39. She'd only been back at work for a few years after maternity leave. But as it turned out, that tap on the shoulder was the best thing that could have happened to her.
The job with BHP was my dream job. I looked at being a scientist from when I was really small. I loved making mud pies out of different things and drying them up, much to my mother's disgust. And when it was announced that there would be changes to the jobs, I knew it was coming, but it really doesn't prepare you for the reality of it. And I wasn't upset on that day or anything. I was just like, okay, wow, this is really happening. BHP gave all of the people that were given redundancies 3 months worth of training to help with resumes and job search and everything related to finding a new role. Part of what they did is they did an interview with you to find out what sort of role you wanted to do, and they had asked me to put aside job applications that were the type of jobs that I wanted to go for. And so the person who was in charge of my particular change management or whatever it's called, her name was Lucy, and she said, you know, these jobs aren't really inspiring to you. If you could do any job at all in the world, what would you do? And I laughed and I said, I'd be a rocket scientist. And it was really a throwaway comment, but it said out loud something that I'd held inside for a long time, that I really was passionate about space and everything to do with space. I really was a closet space nerd. And Lucy said, you know what, let's talk about that. And that conversation is really what catalyzed the change for me. So International Earth and Space Technology is my company, but I'm also a member of faculty for the International Space University, which is based in France. So in short, I'm a space lawyer and scientist.
Wow. That was Kim Ellis, our first genuine rocket scientist here on This Working Life. With me to explore the many facets of redundancy, we have executive coach Amy Poynton. Amy helps people transition to a new job or indeed a new career. Brendan Birchall is from the University of Cambridge. He studied the psychological impacts of unemployment and job insecurity. And former HR director, now performance coach Erin Taplin, who has extensive personal experience with redundancy. Not something that she might put on her CV, but she's generously agreed to share her experience with us. Welcome all.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Brendan, so when we talk about redundancy, often that goes hand in glove with the fear of unemployment. Can you tell us what your research has shown about the psychological effects of unemployment?
Absolutely. So it's different for different people, but for the vast majority of people, it's a negative experience. Even when they don't expect it to be, even when they didn't particularly like the job that they've lost, they suddenly find they've got more time on their hands, and that means they have a lot of time to worry about things. There's less structure their time. They don't know what to do in the day. They can't use their time usefully. They've lost a lot of their goals, the goals that they had through work. Their identity was through work. And lots of their social contacts, people they chat with on a day-to-day basis, were through work. And suddenly, even though they didn't realise those things are important to them, they're lost. And yeah, it can be quite a shocking experience.
How important is identity in terms of how they're feeling about being made redundant?
One of the things that you often hear is people are frightened of being asked what they do. They don't even want to walk down their own street in case they bump into a neighbour and the neighbour says, what are you doing now? And to say you're unemployed has still, even in this day and age, even though we know that unemployment isn't caused by lazy, feckless individuals, it still carries that stigma, unfortunately. And again, in our society today, still, employment is our main source of identity for so many people.
And Amy, given that redundancy is used as a tool quite frequently now for companies, what can companies do at that level to help with this idea of people, their identity, and what might happen with redundancy?
Well, some of the things that Brendan talked about really did resonate with me with what I experience when I'm working with people. And I've worked on redundancies both as a leader where I've had to make my team redundant, as well as today as a coach to help people through the transition. So organizations can either hold that work within their own organization or how they're looking after people to go through the process, or they can work with outsourcing that to specialists like myself or companies that I work with like Directioneering, where we have processes and tools that we're working with the person to get through all the steps, not just that first step of being made redundant, but the roller coaster ride of being made redundant, because you may feel great and then a few weeks later you feel terrible, and then a few weeks later you feel great again, and you really need to be helped and guided through that process.
In your experience, what processes then have been the most effective in terms of helping people?
In the first instance, it's actually them understanding who they are. I call it personal brand. What are all the things that make you who you are? Get that documented, write it out, and build a narrative around that. So when you are walking down the street, the way Brendan talked about, you have something that you're going to say, and we actually role play that. If you run into your dry cleaner, what are you going to say? If you run into somebody you worked with, what are you going to say? And there's a little bit of, you know, fake it until you are it, because, you know, maybe you're not feeling really positive, but having that narrative out to the public is incredibly important. So that's one of the first things.
Do you do that on the company time, or is that something that you need to do after this whole process takes effect?
On so company, like once I find out,
yeah.
Start then. As soon as you possibly can, that you have this, it is a little bit of a shield that you're protecting yourself because you have this story, and then the story builds and builds and builds as you know more and more of what you want to do. The other thing that we talked about was networks. So who are the people that are going to be close to you and supporting you? Identify who those people are and spend time with them or reach out to them so that you're not alone. I think the isolation that Brendan just described of somebody sitting at home, not knowing what to do, not wanting to talk to people, is a very dangerous place for somebody to get to after they've been made redundant. Working with them right away to say, who are your networks? Who's your support? What are you doing every day? What are you doing every week to get out? It is, you know, sounds therapeutic, but it is actually the thing that keeps people moving forward.
And Brendan, what is this idea of a psychological contract?
In lots of employers, and again, you know, particularly good employers, one thing we take for granted is that when our employer wants to do something a bit extra that's not maybe not in our written job contract, we'll help out when unexpected things happen. And we expect the employer to reciprocate so that when we've got some special need, maybe got to take time off to look after a sick kid or go to the school play, they'll reciprocate. And people just take that for granted. It's part of, you know, a good relationship. If redundancies are imposed, and particularly if this is done badly by management, suddenly people realize, no, that wasn't the case. Your employer is not going to look out for you. If they can get a business advantage by getting rid of you, they will. And so people who've either been made redundant themselves or seen colleagues made redundant, suddenly they question that and they realize that their employer isn't the good employer they just assumed they were, and their motivation for their work can plummet. And often employers think they're going to get some benefit from redundancies by downsizing, they make a loss because they lose so much goodwill through this loss of the psychological contract.
And how do you then retain psychological safety and not break that psychological contract, Brendan?
There's all sorts of different redundancies. They affect different people. So when you were talking about the 250,000 last year, a lot of those would actually happen to people where redundancy is quite normal. Say they're in construction or mining, where they're always opening up new construction sites, closing them down, people made redundant. So lots of those people would have already had a few redundancies in their working career, and it's not going to be the big deal for them. But then the sort of thing people that Amy was talking about more, say in the public sector or in professional jobs, redundancy is quite rare there. So in those situations, it has to be much more carefully. And making it seem fair, making it clear that you're doing things in a fair way, you're explaining why you have to do things, that you're looking after people, you're not leaving them in long periods of uncertainty between the announcement of the redundancy and the actual telling them who's staying and who's going. So it's not easy. It's difficult to manage well, but that seems to make a big difference.
I'm Lisa Leong. Today on This Working Life, we're reframing redundancy. With me is unemployment researcher from Cambridge University, Brendan Birchall, performance coach, Erin Taplin, and executive coach, Amy Poynton. Erin, tell me about your experience of voluntary versus involuntary redundancy.
In terms of my experience, with the voluntary ones, I was able to engineer it, to have control over it, to have input into how the announcement was written, how it was put out there when I left, the whole piece. The two involuntary ones came at me out of nowhere, absolutely cut me off in the knees. One of them was literally in a dark corner office that I did not see it coming at all, so that for the next job after that, every time my leader wanted to meet me in a meeting room we didn't normally meet in, I had panic attacks because I didn't know what it was going to mean. The trauma. The last one in December was actually the best one. And that is because while, you know, Amy talked about the structures that outplacement organisations provide, which are incredibly important, when it happened to me a fourth time, I'd already been through three rounds of outplacement, so I knew what I needed to do. And what made the difference for me was I'd been heavily involved in that organisation's LGBTI network in establishing it, and it was grassroots, and it was very much, I had genuine connections with people all over the place, and they sustained me. People reached out to me, they looked after me, they cared for me, they took me for coffees. Whenever I reached out to them very proactively, because one of the things with redundancy, to make it work for you, you have to try and control as much as you can and be as proactive as possible. And it's much easier to do things when you have a job than when you don't have a job. So to Brendan's point about locking yourself away at home, one of the things that I've really learnt is the key is your mental and emotional state. You have to do whatever it takes to stay in the right space.
And obviously that's hard when it's involuntary. So what effect did that have on you getting out and being proactive with your new job?
The second involuntary one was in 2012, and I didn't work for an organisation again till 2015. So I focused on starting up my own business and hanging out with the kids, but it also coincided with the end of my relationship with their father. So in hindsight, I can see that there was just this emotional turmoil going on that I didn't recognise, and I lay on the lounge a lot, and ate a lot of Nutella. And so when it happened the fourth time, I was not going to sit on the lounge and eat Nutella, and I didn't. And I got a job in 2 months over the Christmas period, which anybody who's job hunting over Christmas knows how hard that is.
So looking back, what would you advise someone to get out of the Nutella rut?
Establish your networks. You've got to do two things. You've got to have the structures that organisations like Directioneering provide. You also need to have the emotional support. So find other people who are going through what you're going through. But most of all, surround yourself with positive people, people who are solution focused. You don't want to be with people that are commiserating on what a rotten situation it is. It's not helpful.
I've got to unpack something. How did you engineer your own redundancy?
The first one, I'd come back from maternity leave and they'd replaced me while I was away, and they liked both of us and they didn't know which one to keep. And I said, get rid of me, because I've had 15 years in this industry and I want to work in a new industry. So that was that one. And with the second one, I was heavily pregnant and they made my entire team redundant and wanted to keep me because they didn't want me to get litigious. And I said, I'll get litigious if you don't let me go, because otherwise I would have come back from mat leave. They would have forced me into something that wasn't me, and then I would have resigned.
Amy, can I pick up something about survivor's guilt then with you? What is it and how does it play out in your experience?
So survivor guilt can happen in the context of what we're talking about here with redundancy. Can be that you've seen, you're working in an organization, you're seeing colleagues leave, there's a shedding of the workforce, and you're staying.
You may even have gotten promoted through all this change. So big organizational change happens, X number of people leave, maybe people you've worked with a long time that you care about. You've been promoted, if that's the scenario, and now you want to be engaged in the company in that new role, but you feel so badly about what's happened to the colleagues around you. And so that's where the guilt comes in. And the converse side of that is, if that's not the rosy scenario I just played out, maybe you've been, the redundancies happen, you've stayed, and you've been put into a role that's commensurable to the role that you have today. It's not something you want to do, but you're told you will be doing that. It's equal. And if you want to resign, you can. You don't want to resign. And now you're a survivor feeling like, why didn't I get a package? I wish I was leaving. So I think there's actually a few different slices of what survivor means. And for those individuals, as a leader in an organization, and this is my lived experience with it, is spending a lot of time with all the people that worked for me, whether they were made redundant or not. And if someone's left that I'm checking in with them, you know, we had 30, 60, 90, 180 day check-ins with all these people to understand where they've landed, how they're going, and bringing that information back into the team to say, oh, I caught up with Erin, I had a coffee with her. She hasn't landed a role yet, but she's done this, this, and this, and she's doing education, whatever's happening. And if someone's not doing well, be honest about it. Look, they're struggling. You know, does anybody have any ideas for them? So even though they've left the organization, there is a duty of care to the whole team. And I think any leader can do that at any time.
That's a great tip for leaders. Mm. What's your experience with that?
I've been well looked after by the people I worked with because of that emotional connection out of the last job. I've also had three situations where at 5 o'clock on the last day, that was it. That's the last I heard of them.
I'm Lisa Leong, and we're on This Working Life here on RN, and we're reframing redundancy. Brendan, do you think redundancy has lost its stigma somewhat because it's so common?
Again, it just depends on the industry. There are some people who will have seen it happening around them. They'll have been through several rounds. They'll have survived some. They'll have moved organisations. And I think going right back to the example we started with, often what seems to be a disaster, a shock at the time, I've noticed this a few times, that when people then talk about those things a few years later, they'll say again and again, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. They were sort of stuck in a job that they weren't that keen on, but all their friends told them it was a good job, it was secure, they thought it was well paid, and it changed their lives. So it's just so different for different people. Some people are made redundant. They know that the newspapers are full of adverts of people just like them. They've had recent training, then qualifications are in areas where everybody wants, and they're going to drift into a new job very easily in a few weeks. Unfortunately, there are other people who they're in the sunset industries. Maybe they're the sort of person who employers have got some prejudice against because they're, say, an older worker. And maybe realistic, they're going to have to say, it's going to be difficult, it's going to be really tough for me to ever find a job again. So that's where that individual counselling is so important, to make sure they've got a realistic understanding of what's out there in the labour market. Because often they haven't, you know, if they've been in a job for a long time, they didn't see it coming. They haven't been looking at what other jobs are around.
Executive coach Amy Poynton, what do you think about, first of all, the stigma question, and then how people are reframing redundancy in their own minds?
So I agree with what Brendan was saying. Over the decades, the stigma has certainly dropped. If you look at something 25 years ago, there would have definitely been more stigma, I think, to be made redundant. And now, sadly, I think it's just all too common that it's used. And I do worry that redundancy is used as a performance management tool rather than really reorganizing the organization because of bona fide change in structure. I think sometimes it's sort of a lazy way out, potentially. But that may be another show. What I would say on it, though, with the stigma is when an individual knows why it's happening, and when they're communicated, you know, what is happening, and the execution of this is good by the manager, so they know how the steps are going to go, whether it's voluntary or involuntary, they get a sense of control very fast because they can understand it, they can get their head around it, they might not be happy, but they can at least say, okay, what can I control in this? And I think if organizations can do those bits well, really explain it well, and it's believable, and what Brendan talked about is maybe employees don't believe that story. And they don't trust. And then that psychological contract's broken. And that's a huge impact for companies because that's their brand. You know, if I've worked at a bank and I'm treated poorly, well, now I'm no longer an advocate for that brand, right? Or if I work at, you know, whatever, a consumer good company, I'm no longer an advocate for that brand and I'm going to tell X number of people that. So I think there's a bigger picture there around the stigma, not just from the employee side, but also the employer.
And over your four redundancies, Erin, what are your reflections on stigma and your identity and those issues?
Look, the first one, even though it was voluntary, I was embarrassed and a whole range of things through to now, if it happens again, I just call it being on hiatus. I'm on a holiday, I'm on hiatus, it's mindset and people believe whether or not you believe it. So you need to believe it. You need to be okay with it because then that impacts how you put the message across. So one of the things Amy said earlier on was framing up how you talk about it when you're walking down the street and you run into somebody. That is so important. And it's little bits of tweaking that make the message come across more effectively and make it believable for you. And that's really important because you really don't know where your job is going to come from, who you're going to meet and where that might lead.
And Amy, how do future employers look upon redundancy, whether it be voluntary or involuntary? Do they care?
So now we're talking about I'm out in the market and I'm interviewing. What am I saying? My experience is no, they don't care that much unless they get a sense that it's because of performance. You know, so that's going to be how you present yourself. I worked with someone who did not want to be made redundant. He was not happy about it. He wanted to stay with the company and he built that into his narrative. So when he was interviewing, he said, I've left this organization. I didn't want to. I wanted to stay. Here are the reasons I wanted to stay. I wasn't able to. And now I'm doing this because he couldn't get past it. So he said, well, let's just build it into your story then, because it's quite powerful. You have a message here and you have a loyalty. And let's sell that. And it was great. He had a really good story.
That's an important point about the narrative that you want to tell. I was reading that you could say I was made redundant or you could say my position was made redundant.
Yes.
And that's one slight tweak.
Yes.
What do you think about how you might advise someone on telling their story?
What you just said is really good to think about with the language. It could be talking about it in an organizational context. So get it really far away from you and very far away from individuals. Mining is going through changes because there's less production and there's less sales. And so as an industry, we've had to readjust. And so that means I'm doing this other thing different. You're not even talking about yourself as an individual then.
Let's go now to our rocket scientist and lawyer, Kim Ellis, to give her the last word.
I think the hardest part about facing a redundancy is you feel like maybe there was something that you could do to prevent it, as if somehow it was in your control, but it never is. And so if you can let go of the idea that you were ever going to be able to control it, it makes it much easier to face. I remember thinking at the time, it was really personal, but it wasn't. Redundancies never are, and it's really important to learn that. It's just for companies, there are a variety of different reasons why they make positions redundant. And it's been 10 years since my redundancy. And what's interesting is that when I look back on how much uncertainty I was facing at the time, I would never have imagined the type of roles that I've been able to land in the interim and the amazing experiences that I've had. And I'm so grateful for the redundancy because it completely changed my world for the better, even though it was really painful at the time.
Kim Ellis. I've also been speaking with performance coach Erin Taplin, executive coach Amy Poynton, and researcher from the Department of Sociology at the University of Cambridge, Brendan Birchall. If you enjoy the show, do us a favour. Click on subscribe, give us some stars on iTunes, and share this episode with someone who needs to hear it. This Working Life is produced by Maria Tickle. I'm Lisa Leong. Until next week, keep working.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.